British Public Radio. Nature.
Brought to you with the Nature Publishing Group.
Coming up, tracking polio in Nigerian nomads.
Here's a population that is probably getting polio and they're possibly spreading polio around Nigeria. So if we don't tackle this mobile population, we have no chance of eradicating the disease.
And the father of sociobiology, E.O. Wilson, publishes a book of advice for young scientists.
It's a lot deeper book than a book just about, you know, some guy who goes out and studies ants, because Ed is some guy who studies ants and is one of the leading biological thinkers of our time.
Plus, how rats use their memory to map out their future behaviour. I'm Thea Cunningham.
And I'm Kerry Smith.
Today, much of the world is polio-free. As part of a global eradication campaign, the disease, which paralyses its young victims, has been vanquished from all but three nations. One of these unlucky places is Nigeria. Nigeria began its polio eradication program in 1996, and it's made some progress. But there are still some stubborn obstacles in the way. One challenge is finding some of the people who need vaccinations, because Nigeria's north is home to large populations of nomads. On a recent visit to Nigeria, Nature reporter Ewan Calloway saw firsthand the difficulties of trying to eliminate a disease in a country containing mobile groups of people in hard-to-reach areas. He's written about his experience in a feature and he joins me now in the studio. Ewan, tell me, how big a problem is polio in Nigeria?
Polio isn't a huge problem in Nigeria compared to other diseases. About 100 children got polio last year in Nigeria. But what's important is that that's more than any other place in the world. Nigeria is one of the three countries in the world that has never ended transmission of polio. So during this global polio eradication campaign, the world is kind of looking towards Nigeria and throwing, you know, lots of money to try and bring those 100 cases down to zero, because that's what you need to do in an eradication campaign.
And part of the reason for those cases, it's believed, are the nomads living in Nigeria. And you travelled with some epidemiologists to locate those nomad communities.
Yeah. So the epidemiologists I followed about a year ago or so, they identified nomads. There are millions of them in Nigeria, Fulani nomads, as a missing piece of the puzzle. So these eradication campaigns were going through cities and towns and villages amongst settled people and vaccinating as many children as possible. But the Fulani nomads were almost completely ignored, or they were caught just by chance. So these epidemiologists said, you know, here's a population that is probably getting polio and they're possibly spreading polio around Nigeria. So if we don't tackle this mobile population, we have no chance of eradicating the disease. And so that's what they've been doing for the last year or so, is they've been doing the hard work of, you know, going by car, by motorcycle, by foot, by boat to identify where nomads are living, where they're traveling, and, you know, sending vaccination teams to make sure they're no longer being forgotten, that their kids are being vaccinated against polio.
You mentioned earlier that Nigeria was one of three countries that hadn't eradicated polio, the others being Afghanistan, Pakistan. India has been polio-free for about 2 years now. What do you think the likelihood is of Nigeria being able to have the same success?
Well, India was long thought to be the Waterloo of the polio eradication campaign. Everyone thought this was going to be the last country on earth to eradicate polio. But, you know, you said they haven't had a case in 2 years. Just by having, you know, a really solid, well-organized campaign, getting everybody on board. And Nigeria needs to do the same thing. When I was in Nigeria, there were Indian epidemiologists who had been, you know, veterans of their successful eradication campaign, advising the Nigerians on what you need to do, on that you need to make sure that, you know, as many children as possible. 95% of the children in India, 95% of children under five were vaccinated. In parts of Nigeria, it's less than half. So I think organization, dedication, those sorts of things, I think that's what Nigeria really needs to do.
In terms of the concept of eradication, do the benefits of eradicating an infectious disease really outweigh the costs, you know, and the resources that must be plied into these sorts of efforts?
Right. Polio eradication, $10 billion plus, it's probably going to go past $15 billion by the time it's complete. It's lasted 25 years, missed three deadlines. Is it worth it? A lot of people have asked. Most people aren't questioning whether we should abandon polio eradication. We've come too far, almost everyone says. But it really begs the question, is it worth eradicating other diseases? People are talking about measles in the future. And there are real pluses and minuses. The plus is that once you eradicate a disease like polio and smallpox, which was eradicated in about 1980, you never have to deal with that disease again. There's no burden. And you also get, with an eradication campaign, a lot of funders contributing that wouldn't have otherwise. So they're able to bring a lot of resources to the game. One of the cons is that it distracts from other goals. Nigeria basically has a broken public healthcare system. And a lot of the problems that people face, measles, malaria, meningitis, they're a far bigger burden than polio. And so people are asking, you know, why spend all this money on polio when you're not meeting these basic healthcare needs?
And when a disease like polio, you know, is eliminated from a country, just how certain can we be that it won't return?
That's a really good question, because polio causes this kind of paralysis, but so do other things. And you need to have good surveillance to make sure that you, when you say you've got zero cases, you really have zero cases. So that's going to be kind of an ongoing issue long after Nigeria gets to zero cases, and I really think they will get there. There's going to be this lingering question over, you know, are there really no cases? It really is just making sure that when we say we've eradicated it, we really have. And that's going to be a decade-long goal, at least.
Ewan Calloway there. You can read more about the task of stamping out polio in his feature, available at nature.com/news. There's also a video of Ewan's trip and his encounters in Nigeria available on the same site or on Nature's YouTube channel. Still to come, plant roots protected by friendly bacteria and super-powered gene switches. That's in the research highlights.
But first, remember that time you got lost coming home from the pub? Yes, quite. Well, anyway, the way we get around is intimately connected with our memory. But it's been difficult to see how the brain uses memories to plan its future, like which route back from the pub is shortest. A brain region called the hippocampus is crucial to memory. For navigating in particular, it has a set of cells called place cells, which basically act as a GPS map. David Foster and his colleague Brad Pfeiffer at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore have been trying to figure out how these cells help plan future routes. They've been using rats to map the place cells that spark when the rats are navigating back to a tasty treat. I spoke to David Foster and started by asking him to describe what the hippocampus does.
If I was to ask you, what did you have for breakfast this morning, you would have to go back in time in your mind and relive the experience. Perhaps find yourself sitting at your kitchen table and look down and see what you're eating, and that way you'd tell me the answer. Because you wouldn't have rehearsed that answer, you wouldn't expect that I was going to ask you that question. And this particular kind of mental time travel is associated with the hippocampus.
And more recently, other functions have been proposed for the hippocampus, haven't they? I mean, I'm thinking here of imagining the future, or perhaps planning.
Right. So interestingly, patients with hippocampal damage who also have who classically have these memory problems also have problems with imagination. So somehow there's a link between reconstructing your past experiences into a meaningful story and being able to imagine new experiences, presumably using your memories to do so, but to construct episodes that haven't precisely happened before.
And let's zoom in to the way in which the brain actually does this then. We're in the hippocampus here. And what do we already know about how the brain kind of looks as it processes these two different sides of the coin, if you will?
Right. So in animal models, for example, in rats, it's been found that individual neurons in the hippocampus will respond when a rat is it occupies a particular place. So imagine a rat running around an environment. He's continuously passing through different areas that different neurons respond to. And so it's like a map of the space. This has been a very intriguing idea for a long time, but it's not clear how this map corresponds to memory. And the big problem is, if the animal is trying to remember how to get somewhere, but he's somewhere else, what we thought we knew was that the place cells will just fire relevant to where he currently is, but there's no other information about anything he wants to do or remembers having done anywhere else in the environment. So this idea that place cells really stick you in the current location but don't allow you to look ahead or think back has been a real challenge.
And in this report, then, you were trying to get at some of these questions. So you had these rats sort of running around an arena, trying to remember where home was and where they had to get a reward, which sounds delicious, liquid chocolate.
Right. They like the chocolate. Yes, the second thing we had to do was we had to have a task where really there were lots of places that the animal could potentially be interested in. And we have these little wells where the chocolate will pop up through a tube, and we can control that. There are 36 of them spread out uniformly across this arena. And essentially, the one that the animal has to remember, he has to distinguish from the other 35. So this now gave us a powerful task. So we could see if the sequences really mark out that particular well.
And take us through, then, your results.
Right, so what we found was that in this task, where the animal has to find his way back to a remembered goal location, whenever he's out in the environment and he's got a couple of seconds before he's going to run back to the remembered home, at that point the hippocampus will produce a brief burst of activity across all the cells that we're recording from, which means the whole hippocampus basically is being very active within a very short period of time of about 100 milliseconds. But that activity isn't random or noisy. It precisely depicts a trajectory in space that moves from where the animal is all the way to where he's planning to go. And moreover, the specific trajectory that you see predicts the trajectory that the animal will take to get there.
So it's basically a bunch of virtual maps, almost, detailing the rat's next options.
Right. Well, in a way, it's the act of looking at the map. So we sort of, if you like, had the passive paper of the map, but we didn't have the routes. I mean, if you're reading a map, you look at where you're trying to get to, and you plan a path from one to the other with your eyes. In a way, this is what we have, the passive substrate that corresponds to the paper that the map is written on was understood. It's there, it was the place cell responses. But now we have the act of tracing out what you're planning to do as you get from one place to the other.
And that's kind of amazing, because basically before the rat moves back to a home location, for example, you can tell that it's going to do that. You can predict what it's about to do. One more question, David, very quick one to end on. Which way is it to the nearest liquid chocolate well?
Well, you know, the candy, as they call it here, it's much better in the UK than it is over here. So your chances of finding a satisfying chocolate treat are probably higher than mine.
That was David Foster at Johns Hopkins University.
Research highlights now with Adam Rutherford.
Biofilms, sticky mats of bacteria, are best known for causing persistent infections in people and animals. But luckily for plants, biofilms from a certain soil bacteria might lend a helping hand by protecting their roots from pathogens. A team in the US has shown molecules on the surface of Arabidopsis root cells can send signals that activate the bacterial genes involved in making biofilms. What's more, these plant molecules provide building blocks for the glue bacteria to stick together. So it would seem plants help bacteria to help them. Learn more in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Some genes are switched on by short segments of DNA called enhancers. Now it turns out enhancers can boost their power by huddling together to form super enhancers. US researchers have found that these lengthy stretches of DNA can bind more proteins that activate gene transcription than standard enhancers. Human cells contain tens of thousands of genes and many more enhancers, but most are controlled by only a few hundred super enhancers. The team say the superpowered switches generally form at genes associated with cell identity, suggesting the two together help define cell type. And that study was published in the journal Cell.
E.O. Wilson is a Harvard biologist, described as the father of sociobiology, the study of how social behaviour evolves. He spent a lot of time studying ants, who have very interesting social lives, and he's a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. seems like a good person to take advice from, and in his latest book, Letters to a Young Scientist, this is precisely what he offers. Somewhere between a memoir and a guidebook, it chronicles his 7 decades of scientific experience and offers up what he has learned about how to make it in the world of science. Noah Baker spoke to ecologist Stuart Pym of Duke University in North Carolina, who's reviewed Letters to a Young Scientist for Nature this week.
Wilson offers a lot of advice from his experience and so on. Could you give us sort of a lowdown of the most important things that you sort of got from this piece of work?
Yeah, I mean, it's almost passion, passion and passion. I mean, it's clear throughout the book that Ed's enthusiasm for ants in particular permeates everything. There's also a sort of a lovely section about, don't you have to be incredibly bright to be a scientist? And Ed says, well, no. In fact, people who are incredibly bright sometimes make rather poor scientists because, as he argues, they have it too easy. You know, it sort of helps to have to struggle a bit. It builds character. And so, along the way, he tackles in this very sort of disarmingly friendly way, you know, some of the obvious challenges that people might prevent them from being scientists.
There have been lots of careers guides that have been written for scientists. What's new about this particular book?
You know, one might have approached this book in some sort of dry and authoritarian tone. You know, you must do this and you mustn't do that, and, you know, these are the 10 principles to become a great scientist. It isn't like that at all. I think what makes this so compelling is its narrative. It starts out with him being a teenager, and it's sort of a soup to nuts accounts of his career. It takes him to where he is now, but along the way it's an unashamedly passionate and honest and enthusiastic journey of the sorts of things that he's done and what he's found to be interesting, and above all about the role that ants have played in his life. Now, he makes the point that it doesn't have to be ants, but, you know, it has to be something. And it's a matter of, following your spirit and upon that becoming a good scientist.
The book, as you say, is quite a personal account of Wilson's own scientific career. But it's also very personal to read, isn't it? It directly addresses you throughout the book as the young scientist reading the book.
Absolutely. It's the sort of thing that you can imagine Ed, you know, being there and talking to you as you read it. And I've been privileged to watch Ed talk to young people over the years, and he is hugely engaging personally when he talks to young people, to young scientists in particular, and that comes across brilliantly in this book.
And so, as you say, he speaks a lot about ants and about his career. How much is this really relevant to other areas of science?
Well, I think it's hugely relevant, and I think if you look at this with the sort of a view that ants are metaphor, you'll be fine. I mean, whatever it is, you've got to have that passion. It's got to be something you really want to know about. And from there, other things follow. I mean, you could really sort of go through this book and substitute a lot of other things besides ants and get a much more general book. And I'm thrilled that he hasn't. I'm glad he didn't try to write something pretentious by taking ants out of the story. Ants are his story, but they could be anything.
Will you be using these letters to advise your students in the future?
Oh, you bet. I mean, my students will be reading this book. They will be looking at its lessons, and you know, it's a great basis for talking about the kinds of issues that we all face as our careers develop. It's a lot deeper book than you know, a book just about, you know, some guy who goes out and studies ants, because, you know, Ed is some guy who studies ants and is one of the leading biological thinkers of our time.
That was Stuart Pym talking to Noah Baker. You can find that review at nature.com/news.
News time now, and welcome to Richard Van Norden. Richard, 3 pages of the news section this week are about Obama's new budget request to Congress for $143 billion.
Yes, it's Obama's 2014 request to Congress, where he lays out, as it were, the starting bid that they can argue over. And for science and technology, there's just a 1% rise from the 2012 request. So a modest increase, a cautious increase, but very much directed towards research areas that promise near-term economic and social benefits, and leaving some more basic research out in the cold.
We'll come back to the implication of that later and what's actually being funded and cut back, but 1% overall is indeed an increase, nevertheless. It might be small, but that's better than nothing, isn't it, in these times?
Yeah, well, the subtext is that there is, separately to the budget negotiations, enormous across-the-board cuts taking place in the US right now. You might remember that this thing called the sequester is happening, in which, well, for research, about 5% is being slashed across the board, across all research areas. It's ongoing until Congress decides to stop it. And that means that, well, Obama's 1% increase, if it passed, would translate into a 4% decrease. So don't go thinking there's more money for science. There will probably be less money. But Obama is at least trying to keep everyone's hopes up. The 2013 budget, which we are spending on right now, has not actually been passed yet. Congress is still working on it, what's called a continuing resolution, keeping spending at the same levels from 2012. That's why we're comparing all of these prices to 2012 budgets.
I see. And in terms of the things that are getting funded more or less now then, you mentioned that translational research is more popular in this budget request than basic science.
Exactly so. So, well, for example, the National Science Foundation is going to get an 8.4% boost over 2012 levels in the budget. But much of that increase is going to very purpose-driven initiatives, such as a project for cyber-enabled materials and manufacturing for materials and things like turbines and robotics that could aid manufacturing. And the engineering division has got a very applied focus, and that's getting a 10% boost. In the National Institutes of Health, similarly, getting just a 1.5% boost. But this new Center for Advancing Translational Research, which wants to speed treatments from labs to patients, is getting a 16% jump. Alzheimer's disease, which is a special priority for the White House, is getting a little extra sort of 10% hike. And the Department of Energy, which has always kind of been a tension between basic and applied research, it's supposed to support applied work on extracting energy. In that department, the DOE gets an 8% increase, but again, the largest increase is for initiatives targeting energy efficiency and manufacturing and renewables. Interestingly, one of the key projects that departing Energy Secretary Stephen Chu promoted, the Advanced Research Projects Agency Energy, ARPA-E, kind of the equivalent of DARPA, they want a 40% rise in funding for that. So a few projects are getting major increases.
And is this a sign overall of the more austere times? People want more bang for their buck, more obvious payoffs?
Exactly so. And it's kind of hard to know whether we can really measure the value that we're getting from these supposed projects to boost the economy. Julia Lane, who's an economist at the American Institutes for Research in Washington, and last year she headed NSF efforts to measure research outputs. And she says it's very hard to measure the social return that you get from mission-driven research.
So difficult to measure sometimes the outcome, perhaps, of these kinds of budgets. What about the reaction from scientists?
Well, scientists are obviously concerned that they're losing money for basic research. So at the National Institutes of Health, which gets about $30 billion from Congress, the proportion of this money spent on basic research was about two-thirds in the 1980s and 1990s, but it's fallen to about half today. Congress is just saying, where are our cures? Where are our treatments from this money? It's interesting that even new projects from the White House that are really basic research, such as the Brain Initiative, where the idea is to create tools to record the activity of millions of neurons in the brain, really a basic research project. The White House is carefully spinning it as an applied project that will immediately be key to understanding and coming up with new cures for brain diseases. Maybe that's for the far future, but it's certainly not going to happen in the next 5 to 10 years.
All right. Thanks, Richard. Remember, you can read more on that story and more at nature.com/news. That's all for this week. Join us again next time as we anticipate the latest version of the Psychiatry Bible. I'm Kerry Smith.
And I'm Thea Cunningham.